TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate scientist Kevin Anderson on the unforgiving math for staying under 2 degrees. Two numbers haunted the climate negotiations of COP21 in Paris in December 2015. 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. Finally, the vast majority of the world's countries agreed that global warming may not go over 2 degrees and that we really ought to stay under 1.5 degrees to save the island states and low coastal areas that are already flooding at the current 1 degree Celsius warming. Kevin Anderson translates those numbers for us. He's professor of energy and climate change in the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He's deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. He gave a radical on-the-spot analysis of COP21 right there, on location in Paris, to Kevin Kainers. Kainers' radio blog, The Elephant, focuses on climate change. In part one of this program, Anderson explained the carbon budget. In 2011, the IPCC said that no more than 1,000 billion tons of CO2 may be emitted between 2011 and 2100 to save the life support system of the planet. Kevin Anderson took apart that formula and said, since 2011, we already emitted 150 billion tons of CO2. That's 15% of the whole budget in 4 years. At current consumption rates, it would take under 20 years, not 90 years, and the budget would be spent completely. At this point, emissions are rising rather than going down. The 2015 emissions are 60% higher than they were only a quarter century ago. Anderson said, it's about what happens in the next 5 years that matters. We need a rapid and deep reduction bordering on 10% a year if we talk about stabilizing climate by the end of the century. However, politicians and some scientists claim that we will invent technologies that remove carbon from the atmosphere and therefore no urgent action is required now. In the alphabet soup of abbreviations, you will hear about BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. That's the so far elusive promise to find a way to extract the already emitted CO2 from the air and store it underground. What Anderson calls a Dr. Strangelove plan. Here's Professor Kevin Anderson.
There's a prospect of a future technology which will suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That is now embedded in almost all of the main models that are informing governments. The detailed climate models, not the physics models that look at climate, but the models that combine that physics with economics and behaviour and politics and these sort of what are called integrated assessment models. These models are the ones that inform the policymakers. They're called cost-optimising models. They work out what's the cheapest way of holding the 2 degrees centigrade. And they almost all show the same thing, which is the technology we don't have now, if that comes into place in 2050 to 2070 and sucks the CO2 out of the atmosphere, sucks the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, then we don't have to make such big changes today.
So we're pinning our hopes on a technology that doesn't really exist yet.
Without a doubt, that is the underpinning of almost everything being discussed in Paris. All the discussions about the INDCs, saying the INDCs are 2.7 degrees or 3 degrees, all of that is premised on assuming we can suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere a long time in the future. No one even talks about it now. That technology that does not exist is just assumed to work. And it's been completely normalized. A lot of climate scientists are, particularly the, sort of the natural scientists and some of the physicists, are really very concerned about this, but they're not quite so vociferous yet in voicing that concern, though that is changing. Here it's changing in the big climate change conference from the scientific community that was in June in Paris, actually, this year. There are lots of people there really genuinely deeply concerned about these integrated assessment models and their reliance on this technology that doesn't exist a long time in the future. Dr. Strangelove, I don't know if you've ever seen the film, but I was thinking of it as a Dr. Strangelove technology. It may work, But the idea to assume that it will work is really very dangerous.
And what do you think the effect of this built-in assumption is? Is it dangerous that everyone has this built-in assumption?
Well, it's incredibly dangerous, because what it allows us to do is effectively use an incremental adjustment to business as usual. It allows us to carry on, smile at these events, pat each other on the back, and leave here on a plane to go home once we've got the taxi to the airport, and live in our biggest homes. Because negative emissions in the future, we just turn the dial up and that'll suck the CO2 out. Okay, we have to make some adjustments. We have to gradually move towards renewable energy and maybe eliminate fossil fuels in the system in the next 70, 80, 90 years that some people have been talking about and from the IPCC have been talking about as well. You know, this doesn't fit at all with a 2°C framing unless you can suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere. So it fundamentally changes what we're prepared to talk about here. And even the idea that people say, well, the INDCs are in line with 2.7 degrees, you know, that is repeated here in many venues. Yet the people who are saying that never understand, or virtually never understand, that behind that is an assumption that huge amounts of carbon dioxide are going to be sucked out of the atmosphere in years to come. And a very common technology for that, planned technology, is something called BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And they're going to plant places like, you know, they could be huge. Some of these scenarios assume places as big as India or larger, planted with biomass, harvested every year, transported around the world to power stations, burned in power stations, the carbon dioxide captured, liquefied, pressurized, and put down into a reservoir somewhere under the ground and held there for 1,000+ years, safely without leaking, more than 1,000+ years, safely without leaking. That's the premise. That's what we're assuming is going to occur. At the same time, we're trying to feed 7 to 9 billion people on the planet. The aviation sector thinks it's going to use biomass for flying the planes. The shipping industry thinks it's going to use biomass for powering its ships. The car industry is already using biomass, and the chemical industry thinks it will use biomass for chemical feedstock. So you've got all the sectors thinking, oh, we're going to use this biomass, this magical fuel that's going to save the world, you know. And people need to sit back and think, we've got a round planet, we've got changing temperatures, we've got 7 to 9 billion people, we've got, you know, we have this changing climate. Is this in any way realistic? And lots of the people now, lots of scientists are saying, no, it's not. And there are some papers now coming out suggesting this looks incredibly dangerous set of assumptions to build our current policies on.
Is this what you mean when you talk about how there's a bias even within the scientific community of kind of tweaking the numbers so that we get a conclusion that is palatable, that we can digest?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there are a number of ways we do it, but that is the most powerful one that is used. I mean, another one is that we assume global emissions will peak very early. So quite a lot of the scenarios in the IPCC assume global emissions have already peaked.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of the scenarios. And the UNEP GAP report, and a lot of the scenarios there have assumed global emissions have already peaked. So, you know, we have this one where we're going to use lots of negative emissions. We also assume a very, very early peak, or possibly a peak in the past, which is even more challenging. There's often a very naive assumption on the uptake of technologies, how rapidly they can penetrate the system. Now, they can do a lot with technologies, but we have to be more realistic about how they can be factored in and what that would actually mean. You know, do we have enough people trained to do these things? Can we move them off other things that they're doing and move them onto, you know, pushing forward a very low carbon agenda? I just don't think people really think this through on a sort of system level basis. They do it with their algorithms and with their computer models and their equations, and I think there's a real danger in that. I call it non-contextual. They don't really step outside and look at the world within which they live and say, how would you deliver that here in the next few years? But it allows us, by adjusting those assumptions, it allows us to fit within the current political discourse. And again, that's the one that you hear. You hear that sort of language, green growth. You know, we can have our cake and eat it. You hear that repeatedly. It's just rubbish, you know, win-win opportunities. There are some win-win opportunities here and there, but by and large, we're going to have to make such large changes that the way we would normally measure these sorts of successes in our society, you know, would not be successes. You know, that we would measure that as being not so positive. So things like economic growth, we will probably have to question whether that's viable in the short to medium term for the wealthy parts of the world. Certainly wealthy people within the wealthy parts of the world, that is unlikely to be viable. Well, almost certainly will not be viable in the 2°C framework. You know, people will have to take a significant economic hit. Their positional goods, the way that they see themselves in society, will have to change. Now, it doesn't mean we have to have a low quality of life. We can still have a very high quality of life. But those adjustments, at the moment, we would measure those things as not, or see those things as not being particularly positive.
I'd be curious what it's like for you personally to work in this area, especially without a lot of the comforting assumptions that other scientists or people in the environmental movement use. I imagine that can't be easy, because just thinking about that last point, well, how likely is it politically that the most powerful people and nations in the world are suddenly going to say to themselves, we can't grow our economies anymore?
Very few of them. And that's partly because we've become dominated by a particular group of economists. This wasn't the same 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, they dominate every facet of our lives now, whether that's in governments, whether it's in universities, whether it's in our schools. I mean, everywhere our lives are dominated by a particular way of looking at the world. but that's new and that is constructed. We don't have to have it like that. There are ecological economists out there look at the world differently. There's people like Herman Daly, very influential, used to be in the World Bank, Stiglitz of this world or the Piketty of this world. There are people questioning some of these things. So it is being questioned a little bit now, this particular economic paradigm that we have.
But what is it like for you personally?
For me personally?
Because, I mean, you obviously have to contemplate a lot of scary scenarios.
Yeah. And there are two ways. Firstly, from a personal point of view in terms of being isolated, I don't feel quite so isolated. I feel there are lots of other people now saying these sorts of things. Now, often they won't say them publicly, and they'll use a form of language which is slightly different to mine. I quite appreciate the fact that you have to have a... Yeah, we all communicate in the way that we think is most appropriate for us. I do think it has to fit with the science. Some people might argue my language is slightly more colourful. I think the adjectives I use fit very well with the numbers. So I don't feel I'm misusing the adjectives. I think, you know, if numbers look dire, then I use the adjectives that say it's dire. But other colleagues find that slightly harder to do, and they will, you know, use slightly different language. Nevertheless, I mean, the event was at today. I think some of the colleagues on the stand, I don't think 5 years ago they would have said the things they were saying. And I hear that from not just from early career academics, I hear that from quite a lot of senior academics who are saying things that are really quite challenging for society. I mean, you know, as a very clear example of someone who's held up in high esteem in places like Germany and elsewhere across Europe, people like John Schellenhuber now is saying things that, you know, are very difficult for our current economic framing of society. You know, you could argue the Pope's coming out and saying these things as well. So, you know, there are very senior people saying these sorts of things. The IMF, you know, pointing out the huge subsidy for fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency coming out and saying we're aiming for 6°C. That's our trend line, and that's with devastating consequences for the planet. The IEA saying that. There are established figures and institutions that are saying things that are fairly radical, as well as the sort of more detailed stuff that I and increasing numbers of people are saying. So it's much easier now than it was 2 or 3 years ago. 2 or 3 years ago, I found it very difficult. So it's not too challenging for me from that point of view. The way it is challenging is actually trying to live in a world where, I mean, the flying one is not easy for me. I think we should have to accept the fact it will not be easy. Academically, it's less of a problem. It doesn't mean that I spend a bit more time away from home than I would like to do, and it takes a lot more organisation.
And what about anxiety for the future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of that. And I think, but a lot of people in NGOs and elsewhere feel that as well. But it is a rich middle class person's anxiety. A lot of people have anxiety around the globe, and they're worrying about where the food comes from tomorrow, or what's going to happen to them 2 weeks down the line, or that huge flood in India. Now that's what they're dealing with. So I'm still
contemplating the end of the world, essentially.
It is, but I'm not going to worry about my Western anxieties. I think I can deal with those. I think a lot of other people have got a lot more immediate anxieties, which maybe not the end of the world, but it's the end of their lives or their family's lives, or at least a reasonable livelihood. So, you know, I'll take that hit because I work in this particular area. I see these things. I don't find that a problem. But the personal things are like. I'm a keen rock climber. A lot of my rock climbing friends go away climbing for weekends or for the odd week here and there to Morocco or to somewhere in Norway for ice climbing in the winter. I can't join them because they just jump on a plane and off they go. So that has affected my friendships there. I have an uncle at home very close to who lives in Australia, a lovely man. I will never see him again. Now, that's not easy. He's old, not very well. I would love to see him. I've not seen him for 11 years. And I will likely never see him again. I can only talk to him or Skype him or whatever it might be. And that is not easy. So personally, that is very challenging. But if I go to see him, unless I can get there slowly, maybe if he's still around when I'm retired, then maybe I'll try and go to see him. But if I was to fly there, the emissions are so high from that particular journey, I think, well, that would have an impact on poor people living in Bangladesh. Now, I don't know which one it will be over there, but it will significantly add to the burden for these people. And I can't justify that. So therefore, I can't go and see him.
But couldn't you say that because you're working your whole life on climate change and trying to promote the types of actions required that then it's justified in a way?
Lots of environmentalists say that. Lots of my scientific colleagues say that. In fact, very few people don't think that. I mean, I found it very depressing. On the second day I was here, I talked to a really good scientific colleague of mine, an excellent scientist, and he said, I can justify flying here from a provincial town in the UK because I do good work on climate change. Yeah, I just think, I haven't met anyone who doesn't think differently. The business community thinks it has to fly and has to have a larger amount of carbon dioxide because it feeds into prosperity in our society, but allows us to buy more expensive renewables as they see it. The aviation sector thinks it's the exception, important for growth, cultural development around the world. Shipping industry, essential for moving of goods around the world. So there's two sectors that shouldn't be included, and in fact are outside UNFCCC, have not submitted any INDCs, and are under almost no control for their CO2 emissions. But then there's the climate scientists who think they should carry on because, hey, we're doing really good things. Where is this person that's going to compensate for everyone else's emissions? So I think we have to be very careful about this particular ruse that we use to justify our it's a cognitive dissonance issue. We know deep down that's not what we should be doing, but that's quite hard to deal with psychologically. So we make out this point that we are the particularly important people. I don't think I'm that important that I should be flying around the world to try and solve climate problems.
And you've, on that note, you also take a very negative stance to carbon offsetting. Can you explain why?
Yes.
Why can't I pay for my flight by planting trees somewhere else?
Yeah. Indulgences.
So you don't think the science behind it is
well, no,
correct?
No, I don't. There's quite a number of reasons against offsets, and I'm not completely opposed to them. So say you plant trees, you fly somewhere, you fly to, you know, New York to Paris to come to this conference, and in doing that you plant a few trees. Your flight is guaranteed to emit a carbon dioxide because you're on the plane. You've also sent a very clear market signal that says, please buy some more planes and build more airports, and those cannot be made low carbon in the future. And you're going to compensate for that by planting a few trees, which you hope will suck the CO2 up over some period in the future. Of course, that period in the future, how do you know that's going to happen? How do you know there's not going to be a movement in pests that mean those trees get killed by changing the climate, bring around new pests? That's happening in the UK. For lots of reasons, lots of trees are dying in the UK now. I'm not saying because of climate change, but because of changes in their natural environment, one way or another. How do you know that in 20 years from now there's going to be some sort of problem with fuel in one part of the world where these trees have been planted? They get chopped down and converted into, you know, just fuel for people to use.
So it's the uncertainty about it?
Yeah, but the uncertainty is there. But it's more than just the uncertainty, because what you have done is put the CO2 in the atmosphere and sent a market signal to expand that particular high carbon form of energy. And what you've done to try and compensate that is plant a very uncertain tree somewhere else. So they're not comparable. That ton in the tree, which is very uncertain, is not the same as the ton you've guaranteed to have emitted, or the ton of CO2 that you're almost guaranteed to have embedded in the expansion of the industry that you've supported. The other problem is that people say, well, can we not just pay for a wind turbine or a solar panel elsewhere? I'm all for us doing that, but not as an offset. So imagine that. We fly somewhere, and we buy some solar panels for an Indian community, a village somewhere, wherever it might be, some poor village that didn't have power before. Great, they've got solar power. I'm all for that. They can access light, they can do extra reading, they can have a television or a radio. They have a television or radio, they now get advertising on the television or radio, because, you know, now that's there. The advertising could be, buy a small petrol scooter so you can travel between the markets. Maybe you can get a small truck to move your goods from one market to another. Great, that's good for development. Not really opposed to that necessarily. But that now means that they're now driving the scooter rather than using the ox or whatever it was they were doing before. And your emissions are still in the atmosphere from your flight. So what you've done over a longer period of time is to help the other part of the world improve their development, and therefore increase their amount of CO2 emissions in the short to medium term. That's not an offset. You probably increased the amount of CO2 emissions, so it's actually worse than doing nothing from a CO2 perspective. But that doesn't mean that I'm saying those people should not have a solar panel. I think we should not fly and we should pay for the solar panel. That's, you know, that's reparation. We are stopping them from developing the way that we developed because we think the carbon dioxide emissions will be too high. But at the moment, what we're saying, well, we want to carry on doing what we've done, as well as benefiting from the fossil fuels in the past. We're going to carry on flying and everything else, and we're going to pay the poor people elsewhere in the world to compensate for that. I think that at every level, scientifically, mathematically, and morally, it is reprehensible to be doing that.
So you'd say it's worse than doing nothing?
In my view, it's much worse than doing nothing, yeah. At lots of levels, you know, not just the scientific way, mathematical way, in terms of carbon dioxide emissions, but also the moral framing that is an appropriate thing to do.
You mentioned that you worked in the oil patch?
Yes, I left school at 16 and did an apprenticeship as an engineer in the Merchant Navy, working on tankers and gas carriers and container ships. And then later on I did an engineering degree, and then I went to work in the oil industry, basically as a design engineer, designing offshore oil platforms, and then in the what's called the hookup and commissioning, the construction of the oil platform offshore, and then partly in the operation of the oil platforms as well. So that's my sort of engineering history. But I was always interested in energy and environmental issues, right from being a child living next door to a nuclear power station where my dad used to work as a fitter, so I used to work on the reactor. And I was interested in those issues right back in the 1970s when people weren't thinking about climate change then, but we're thinking about alternative energy, it used to be called. So we're thinking about how would you go move away to alternative energy sources. It's a long history. All my life I've had an interest in energy, really, thanks to my dad. And for some reason I had an interest in environmental issues, and I don't know where that quite came from, but that persisted. Whether I was working on the ships or whether I was working on the oil rigs, I was always involved in trying to make sure they did things as cleanly as possible. So we didn't release CFCs, which were a big issue when I was on the oil platform, trying to see how can I restore the CFCs and put them back in the system when we're doing maintenance work. So I was always trying to look at it like that. And then I thought this climate change issue came along. This looks really serious. Tried to understand the science. Thought I need to go back to university and find out more. And I've been working on it ever since.
What year was that?
I think it was early 1990s.
So really early on when it was
hitting. Yeah. It was the very early days of sort of climate change being seen as a big... I mean, obviously people had worked on it before, but when it was becoming a vogue issue, I was starting to read quite a lot about it. And I thought, actually, I don't know that much about climate change. I need to find out more. I did as much reading as I reasonably could that was available in 1990. I need to go back to university and find out a bit more detail. And so that's what I did, and I've been working on it ever since.
And was there like an article or something that you remember interacting with that really got you thinking or concerned about it?
No, I don't think it was. And actually, I don't think my life has ever really run like that. There's been one thing that's triggered, occasionally maybe, but generally hasn't worked like that. It's a sense of something. So it, you know, you read bits and pieces and you think about it a bit more. I always think that thinking is very important. I get that with students. Yeah, don't. The first thing is not to read. The first thing is to think. So I was thinking about a lot of issues then and trying to read about it. And I came to a judgment that this is likely to be an important issue. And the studies I did at university when I went back again looked to me that this was a very, very important issue.
And you certainly made the right bet on that one.
Well,
unfortunately.
Yeah, yes, unfortunately. I mean, I genuinely wish the skeptics were right. I think I wish the skeptics were right much more than them. I would very happily pack up my job and go back to doing something else I would much rather do. I really miss my engineering. I really enjoyed doing it. I feel now I've developed a sufficient expertise in this area that I feel I'm sort of obliged to stick with this area. I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be in COP. I don't enjoy working on climate change particularly. I have some good colleagues, but it's not the sort of terrain that I feel particularly happy with. But I think it's a very, very important subject. And I'm lucky enough to have a set of expertise that has a role to play in it. So I feel some sort of moral obligation to work within this area now. But you know, that's the way it is. I still count myself, I'm a lucky Westerner living a very comfortable life, so I can't complain.
Well, to end off, I'd be curious what gives you hope and resilience going forward, given all the, you've kind of given us a lot of bad news today, Kevin. So you're still working very hard on this issue. Obviously, you're not giving up. So what gives you resilience going forward?
Well, it's more of a moral framework, really. I mean, the science is all well understood, and as far as I can tell, it's completely right. I mean, we well understand climate change. We very clearly know why carbon dioxide emissions are going up in the atmosphere. We know from what sources they're going up, and we know that it links to temperature. All that stuff we know. But exactly what the temperature rise will be for the exact amount of carbon dioxide emissions, there's some uncertainty there. So that helps us. We also have an opportunity to make the big political changes that would be necessary. You know, the door was slightly open on the science, the door was slightly open on the politics. There's not much hope of us pushing hard against any of these. But if we did push really hard, we might push them quite a lot further open, and we could perhaps then move to a different place, you know, a different paradigm, a different way of thinking of these issues. And that's where my hope is, really, is that whilst that thin thread of hope remains, and it's very thin, if I was a betting person, the chances are that we're going to fail. But whilst it remains, it's incumbent on people like me to do my damnedest to try and make sure we bring about those sorts of changes, the necessary changes. We are already too late for 1.5°C, and I know a lot of people are talking about it here, and I think I'm pleased that they are talking about it, and I've had discussions with my colleagues about whether that's a good or a bad thing, but I think politically, I think it's important that they're pushing hard for a lower temperature. I don't think you can scientifically achieve that now. I think it's beyond, our carbon budgets have been blown for 1.5°C as far as I can tell. And that means that we're aiming at 2°C, and that means a lot of people who have had nothing to do with the problem will suffer the repercussions of our profligate use of carbon and knowing profligate use of carbon. So we have effectively in the West, or the wealthy part of the world anyway, we've been like a meteorite that has hit the planet knowingly with a conscience. So, or without a conscience maybe, we've knowingly hit the meteorite, but without a conscience, perhaps that's a better way of seeing it. And I think that's wrong. I think I find that morally, just not appropriate to do that. And if I have some ability to try to change that a little bit, then that's what I try and do. But it isn't one of false hope. I don't think we're going to succeed. But I don't know we're going to fail. And that thin thread, that thin difference between thinking and knowing is what keeps me working on climate change.
Oh, is that what you mean when I saw in the talk that you said that it comes from dealing with just how bad things are that we'll get any hope if there is any to get?
Well, that was saying, that was the thing, as I recall, that was saying that until we recognise how bad things really are, until we recognise the situation we're in now, so it's a bare assessment of the scale of the challenge we face. Because a lot of people say, I take away all this hope. I'm not taking away hope, in my view. What I'm doing is trying to offer real hope. You have to say, where are we today, exactly, precisely, bluntly? We need to understand the challenges we face. And then we can say, well, what can we do about it? But at the moment, we're not even prepared to accept where we are today. We pretend we're somewhere else already. So, in Paris, we should recognise that I always say we need 20 minutes or 20 seconds just to bow our heads in shame. We've had a quarter of a century of doing nothing about climate change. So all the great and the good turning up here, and people, academics as well, in our suits and our tweed jackets. Let's just us remember that we have fundamentally failed the poor and impoverished around the globe. Our failure will have resulted in the many, many deaths and certainly very many impoverished lives of poor people elsewhere who had nothing to do with climate change in terms of causing it. And I have to suffer the repercussions of our failure. And I do think a little bit of humility, a little bit of holding our heads in shame and then standing upright, putting our shoulders back and saying, right, what do we need to do? That's how we should start. But we're not prepared to even do that yet. We're not prepared to acknowledge where we are and what we've done. And that's my point about hope only, useful hope only emerges if we're honest about the situation we face today, and we're not prepared to do that yet.
And last point, people who've been listening, obviously you're saying we need to all reduce our emissions. Once people have done that, what else would you say people need to do?
Two things. First, I'm not saying we all have to reduce our emissions. I'm saying that those of us who are responsible for the lion's share of emissions have to reduce our emissions. Yeah, that's certainly not everyone.
It's probably, most of our listeners.
Well, maybe, yes, okay, I don't know who your audience, but it may well be most of our listeners. Well, it's not only reducing their emissions, it's about reducing their emissions and arguing with their friends, their colleagues, writing to their politicians. It is making the case way beyond just what they do themselves, but actually if you don't do it yourself and argue it elsewhere, you lose credibility. So I think you have to demonstrate action yourself and make the case elsewhere. And the other thing, of course, is that we also have to argue for a rapid shift away from fossil fuels. Fossil fuels, they're very blunt message from this. Fossil fuels have to stay in the ground. 80 to 90% of all the current reserves need to stay in the ground if we're serious of 2 degrees C. So we have to be arguing for that. So the point I made earlier today, countries like Norway, the UK, and someone else made the point about Australia, these are countries with huge renewable energy opportunities, wealthy populations, and very well educated. They should be producing no fossil fuels. So the oil and gas in the UK should stay in the ground, no more shale gas in the UK or development of shale gas. The Norwegians should close down their North Sea oil industry, and the Australians should stop producing coal. We all know that it's fossil fuel use that affects climate change. It doesn't matter how many renewables you've got. If you're still burning the fossil fuels, then that's no good. So if rich countries like ours aren't prepared to do that, then we have no hope. So that's the sort of scale of change that we need, and it's incumbent on your listeners, I would argue, if they think climate change is important, to not only make the changes themselves about how they use energy, but to be pushing really hard for their governments to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy.
Well, Kevin Anderson, thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was the conclusion of an hour-long conversation between Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, and Kevin Caners. Caners blogs under the elephant from Berlin. They met up in the hallway of one of the conference centers at the International Climate Summit, COP21, in Paris in December 2015. Thanks to Kevin Caners for allowing me to broadcast his extraordinary interview. A slightly longer version is posted at his blog, The Elephant. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.